Thank you for downloading this episode of New Books in Sports. I'm your host, Bruce Berglund. For each episode of the podcast, we choose an interesting new book that takes a deeper look at some area of world sport, and we talk with the author. This week's guest is Tony Collins, director of the International Center of Sports History and Culture at De Montfort University. Tony is making a return appearance on New Books in Sports. He was previously a guest in summer 2011 when we discussed his book, A Social History of English Rugby Union. That book, along with two other books by Tony, were awarded the Lord Aberdare Literary Prize, which is given each year to the best work of sports history published in Britain. For this episode, we are talking about Tony's new book, Sport in Capitalist Society, A Short History, just published by Routledge. This book lives up to both parts of its title. First, it shows how the forces of capitalism, commercialization, market competition, industrialization, and the expansion of finance have been essential to the development of modern sport from the 18th century down to today. Second, this is indeed a short history at just under 200 pages. But the book is big in its ideas and its scope. No matter where you live, you'll likely find your country and your sport described in its pages, and then deftly connected to the larger picture of global sport. The book is ideal for a course reading list or for the bookshelf of any educated fan. As always, it was a pleasure to visit with Tony. I hope you enjoy our interview. Tony Collins, welcome back to New Books in Sports.
Great, great to be back.
So it's been a while since we've had you on the podcast, and in that time, of course, there have been some big events for British sport and big events for the Center for Sports History and Culture. So why don't you bring us up to speed on what you've been working on at the center in the last year?
Well, as you say, it's been a big year for sport in Britain. Obviously, the centerpiece was the Olympics, but also things like Andy Murray winning Wimbledon, the first time a British male has won for over 70 years. And if you leave aside soccer, then British sport seems to be on an upward arc. And so we've been, as the Centre for Sport, the International Centre for Sports History at De Montfort, we've been pretty lucky to be at the centre of some of these events from a sort of historical heritage point of view. And I guess some of your listeners will have heard the BBC yes. Radio 4 series that we did in 2000, that was broadcast in 2012, which has been very successful for us. And it's kind of it was very interesting to work on because it made us very aware of how to communicate our work as professional historians to a broader audience. But the other thing that was very interesting was that it caused some quite interesting debate amongst the team about some of the historiographical issues. Mm. So viewing British sport from the mid-18th century to the present day, which was really the time span of the series, was an incredibly useful and thought-provoking exercise just from a historical point of view as much as anything else.
So was there wrangling over who then, which historian was to be interviewed about a particular topic then?
No, not in those terms, but I think in terms of questions about continuity and change within the history of sport. And to what extent, for example, could we say that the arc of amateurism is over? What was the relationship between sport in Britain in the 18th century and the late 19th century, commercialism and amateurism, questions like that? So it wasn't so much that there was a falling out or a dispute in the centre, more a kind of a focusing of minds and re-looking at some of these questions.
Well, let's turn to your book, Tony. The last time we spoke 2 years ago about your history of English Rugby Union, you had just started working on the book. At the time, you were describing it as a history of modern sport, and it's titled "Sport and Capitalist Society: A Short History." And unlike many short history surveys, this book has a definite thesis. It's not simply an overview of the topic based on a survey of the literature. So I'll ask you, what is the main argument of your book, and what interpretations of modern sport are you arguing against?
Well, the thesis is essentially in the title that I've argued that, and to some extent, this is something that, certainly from my perspective anyway, I don't know about the rest of the team, but something that became increasingly clear when we worked on the research for the BBC series, that sport really is a product of capitalist society, that as capitalism developed in Britain in the 18th century, and it brought with it the development of a commercial entertainment sphere, sport was very much part of that. And more than simply being another form of commercial entertainment, sports binary opposition between winning and losing, the importance of competition, really dovetailed with the change in the culture of society as it switched from a feudal, very hierarchical society to the beginnings of a modern capitalist society. So sports development is not simply coterminous with that. I don't think it's not simply an accident that it developed at the same time. But it, in fact, was part of the process of the development of capitalism on a cultural level. And I think we can see that if we look at the development of the laws of sport, the codification of cricket, boxing, horse racing, three main sports of the 18th century Britain. All these, from certainly the early to mid 18th century, developed laws that were firmly based on the commercial development of the sport. So that's the main thesis, and the book tries to track that through to the present day. And really, it's a kind of... I have to say, I was very influenced in writing the book by Eric Hobsbawm's, and I think this is clear, I think if you read the book, Eric Hobsbawm's Age of Capital, Age of Revolution, and that series. So in a sense, it's an attempt to slot sport into Hobsbawm's analysis of the development of modern society. And it doesn't set out to be a particularly polemical or argumentative book, although it is a book of ideas. Mm-hmm. But it does try and I do try and offer an alternative analysis to the idea that the development of sport is one of modernity. It's simply a tale of modernity, which I think you can see in probably the most prominent example of that is Alan Gutman in From Ritual to Record. And I would argue that some of the things that Alan points out as the key markers of modernity are actually very closely related to the development of sport as a commercial capitalist enterprise. And I think there's examples. I mean, I think, for example, Warren Goldstein's fantastic book on the early history of baseball in the States, although obviously Warren probably has a different analysis that I have, it also illustrates the way in which commercialism drove baseball, and I think we can say similar things about soccer in Britain as well. And the other, I guess the other thesis that the book is trying to differentiate, is differentiating itself from, is the idea, which is a sociological idea, of the civilising process, that modern sport is really an example of the way in which modern society from the 17th century became slowly more and more civilised. And I think if you look at the work, particularly obviously of Eric Dunning and the Leicester School of Sport Sociologists, they've spent a considerable time trying to analyse sport and various sports, in fact, in the context of civilisation and the removal of violence from sports. And again, I think if you look at the historical record, so for example, boxing, you know, the most seemingly the most overtly violent sport. The reason why boxing was codified was not to make it less dangerous. And in fact, there's a very strong argument that the Marquess of Queensberry rules that were introduced in the late 19th century made it much more dangerous than the old style prize fighting. But the reason why boxing was codified and common rules were introduced with was simply to make gambling more effective and to make the sport more transparent for the purposes of gambling. And that's something that is actually common to pretty much all sports in the 18th century. So the idea that they're becoming more and more civilised, I think that sport is becoming more and more civilised, I don't think stands up to the test of the historical record. So I guess those are the two main theses that the book is presenting an alternative to. And it attempts to trace the development of sport through the development of capitalism in North America, Europe, Japan, all the way up to the globalization of capitalism over the past 20 or 30 years.
And a good part of the book is devoted to sport in Britain, which is the case with most histories of modern sport. But why is it, in your take and your approach, why is it, or what was it about Britain that made it the cradle of modern sport?
Well, again, this is one of the questions that I think we returned to when we were doing the Radio 4 series, the BBC Radio 4 series, and what were the particular circumstances? Because the standard journalistic argument is that, well, obviously Britain is a sports-loving country, and its love of sport simply meant that it founded all these sports. But in fact, if you look particularly at France in the 17th and early 18th century, you could probably argue that the French were just as sports-loving as the British were. A number of sports like tennis, obviously, can be traced back to their roots, can be traced back to France. There are versions of football, versions of boxing that are prevalent in France as well in the early 18th century. But I think what differentiated Britain and why sport in Britain developed to such an extent and so rapidly was because the aristocracy in Britain had become transformed from a traditional aristocracy based on feudalism, based on a very hierarchical and fixed society. In Britain, because of the English Revolution and the Civil War in 1640s and 50s, the English aristocracy had become much more profit-orientated. The land had become, for the British aristocracy, a way of generating money, a way of generating profit. And therefore, that meant that their natural love of sport, which is common to probably all the European aristocracy, became more than simply a way of killing time. It became a way of making money. Huge amounts of money were gambled on sport. And also it became a representative, really, of the way in which they saw life. It was now about competition, either in the domestic economy or internationally. And, of course, by the time we get to the 18th century, the first British Empire. So the English aristocracy are much more, if you like, profit-minded, competition-minded than any other aristocracy in Europe. And the driving force of capitalist development in Britain, and particularly in the southeast of England, London, the southeast, means that it becomes a tremendously rich area, and the opportunities for leisure time and for that leisure time to be actually very profitable outweigh the possibilities of commercial leisure anywhere else. And that enables British sport to take a hold both as a form of recreation, but also, by the time we get to the wars against revolutionary France in the early 19th century, it also starts to represent, sport also starts to represent not simply competition, but also a form of British nationalism, which is about success of Britain. And so once we come to the mid-19th century, we find that people like Baron de Coubertin in France, many people in North America, particularly in what became the Ivy League colleges, they look to Britain to find the secret of the British Empire, British economic and diplomatic success. And one of the things that is obviously very different in Britain from other countries is the importance of sport. And so many countries decide, well, if sport has made the British successful, we too think that sport is something we should introduce to our countries or encourage in our countries. So sport becomes very important to the British because it's identified with the rise of Britain to become a world power. And then consequently, in the later 19th century, those countries who are looking to become world powers, France, the USA, and then later in the early 19th century, Japan, they look towards the British model, cultural model, to try and develop their national prestige, and sport becomes an important part of that.
You mentioned women in 18th century sport and how there were many more women participating as opposed to in the 19th century. And so knowing something about women in 19th century Europe, that you have a greater division of labor between men and women in the 19th century with industrial capitalism, you have greater division of men and women's space in the 19th century. How did 19th century industrial capitalism play out in terms of men and women in games and in sports?
There's a great book to be written on women's sport in the 18th century, because it's clearly far more widespread than it was in the 19th and in the early part of the 20th century. Women were involved in boxing, for example, physical contests. I mean, I don't want to exaggerate the importance of it, but certainly it's clear that there was a reduction in women's opportunities to be involved in sport in the 19th century. And I would argue that the reason for that is because the change in society to an industrial factory-based economy placed greater emphasis on both men developing masculinity, because one had to be hard to work 14-hour days and to go to find work, but women were triply burdened in their work. They had to keep house and they had to raise children, and in those circumstances, particularly in the great urban industrial centres of Britain at the time, Manchester, Birmingham, Leeds, Newcastle, the opportunities for leisure for working class men were reduced, but for women they were almost completely extinguished, I would argue. And it's really that burden of women, of working class women in the Industrial Revolution and the subsequent period in the 19th and early 20th century that meant that women had far, far less opportunities to be involved in sport. And that only really changes towards the end of the 19th century, when for middle-class women there are huge advances in educational opportunities, both in Britain and North America. And for working-class women, to some extent in the early part of the 20th century, when you get the rise of factory paternalism and welfare capitalism, if you like, when large industrial organisations started to provide some recreational facilities for women. And that particularly becomes very apparent in World War One in Britain, where you get the huge growth of women's soccer teams, which are really facilitated and promoted by the influx of women into the factories and their ability to use the facilities that are provided originally for male workers, once the male workers went to fight in the war to the front, then they were available for women. So you get this. There's a huge, long, I guess, in a sense, perhaps looking at it historically, an interregnum of women's involvement in sport in the 19th century, due primarily to the pressures of industrial society and the prejudices that gives rise to.
So following up on that, looking also at the 19th century, something you talk about in the book is in the 19th century, with the rise of industrial capitalism, this is also the period when team sports develop in Britain, in North America. So what is the connection between team sports and industrial capitalism?
I would argue that, and it's open to dispute, obviously, I would argue that it's really the organisation of daily life for working class people and for a significant section of middle class people as well was based on some kind of collective experience. Working in the factory, leisure was collective, and they went to pubs, they went to music halls. So collectivity became the way in which life was lived. So team sport, the idea of working in a team, was commonplace. And it's interesting, I think, that from the mid-19th century, from the 1870s, when football and also in the States when baseball start to become mass spectator sports with roots in the industrial urban working class, individual sports going to decline. Boxing really doesn't recover until the end of the 19th century. And for the working class, by and large, boxing is the only individual game, and that's only individual sport. Sports like golf and tennis become very important to the middle classes, and they're part of middle class sociability. But for the working classes, both in Britain and North America, and then slightly later in Western Europe, collective team sports, I would argue, come to embody something of their own experience. So one can see people working in the same way on the football field or the baseball diamond. You can see people working the same way that you work in a factory. They're also closely associated with a sense of place that team sports, again, certainly from the 1880s onwards, primarily, but not exclusively, primarily become associated with place. So there's always a home team in a football league or in a football league soccer fixture or a National League baseball fixture. So you have a combination of both collective experience that people can identify with, and also a sense of locality that people can also recognise. And particularly in times of great immigration, which is obviously the case in the United States in the late 19th century, it's a great way of becoming part of a community, of expressing your identity with your new surroundings, with your new town, city, village. And I think that's also the case in a slightly different and less obvious way in Britain, as people move into the cities from the countryside. You find it in Wales with Welsh Rugby Union that Welsh rugby becomes a marker of a new sense of Welshness in the huge industrial developments that take place in Wales in the 1890s and 1900s. So it becomes both a symbol of collectivity and a symbol of place that people identify with, and feeds into people's sense of identity.
Tony, you have a chapter on the origins and the spread of soccer, and you do make an interesting point in that the foundations of modern sport are well established before the most popular sport today, soccer, really has its genesis. And one of the interesting things you bring up in that chapter, so the English bring soccer around the world in the 19th century. It becomes the most popular sport in the rest of the world. But you point out that in other English-speaking countries other than England and Scotland, soccer is not the most popular sport. Instead, other forms of football are more popular in places like the United States and Canada and Australia, but not soccer. So why is that?
Yeah, it's one of the great paradoxes of the world game, that outside of England and soccer, it's not the dominant or the leading sport in any other English-speaking nation. And I think that in a sense that's the key to it. It's about the English and the written and spoken culture of England in the mid 19th century. I think the reason why it's the case is that it's, and I think this also explains why the discussion on why is there no soccer in the United States. I think this is the reason is it rooted in the history of the development of muscular Christianity and ideas about how to educate young men that developed in the mid-19th century. And you can see both in the British Empire, the direct colonies of the British Empire, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, the educational system is based very squarely on the ideas of muscular Christianity and Thomas Arnold and rugby school, and especially on from the ideas of Tom Brown Schoolers, of Thomas Hughes' Tom Brown Schoolers. It was published in 1857, right at this very moment when the development of those societies and the United Canada and the United States as well was undergoing a huge educational shift, and the idea that how do you educate young middle-class men to become the future leaders of these nations and their empires? What are the educational principles that we need to implement? And it was muscular Christianity that really captured the imagination of educators, because, as I argue in the book, it's essentially a form of British nationalism. That it's a way of expressing British values in a more in a very idealized way about how one conducts oneself, how one becomes a man. It's all about males, of course. How these are, again, ideas about fair play, about being a team member, about giving orders and taking orders, about leadership, all these things are popularised in many ways by Tom Brown, by the book Tom Brown School Days, and becomes a huge bestseller across the British Empire and also in the United States as well. And famously, Teddy Roosevelt said it was one of two books that everyone should read. So there's a level of identity. And that opens the door, really, to play rugby. Rugby becomes a game because of its identification with rugby school, muscular Christianity, and Tom Brown School Days. It becomes the game that is played by the local elite. So by the time that soccer becomes the dominant sport, the dominant football code in England, which is only really in the 1880s, up until around about 1880, rugby is probably the dominant, more popular code. But by the time that soccer becomes established as an important football code in its own right in the 1880s, well, the English-speaking world has already adopted its own football. And it very rapidly in Australia, you get both rugby played in New South Wales and Queensland. That becomes very, very rapidly adopted by the elite schools, and then it comes down into the working classes. In the southern states of Australia, you get Australian rules football, which again starts with the elite, based on ideas about muscular Christianity and its applicability to Australia. And in Canada and the United States, rugby is initially adopted and then modified quite quickly, in a similar fashion, really, to which Australian rules modified rugby rules at a slightly earlier period. So by the time that soccer becomes a major sport, the place that it occupies in European and South American countries is already occupied by some variation of the rugby code, if not the rugby code itself. So paradoxically, you have the game that's invented by the English is played, but it never becomes the dominant sport with which the English, other English speaking nations are identified with. And the great paradox of it, or the great irony, whichever way you want to look at it, is that it's soccer that really becomes the internationalist game. It's never seen as it's never identified with any particular nation. It becomes, with the formation of FIFA in 1904, which is not created by any English-speaking countries. In fact, the British don't really like FIFA and don't really want to be a member. By the time that FIFA is created in 1904, then soccer is really pretty much independent of its British roots, and that enables it to spread very, very rapidly, particularly after World War One, throughout Europe and also across Latin America in the same period. So it's a really, and I think one of the things that it highlights, I think, is that, and again, this is one of the things that came out when the Centre was working on the BBC Radio 4 series. It's very difficult to look at one sport in individual isolation. To understand why soccer has spread around the world, or why American football dominates in the United States, or why Australian rules is very strong in Australia, you have to view it in the overall historical context, but also in a comparative context with the other codes of football and other sports, to really understand why these peculiarities, as they seem, have arisen.
I want to jump ahead to the 1920s, Tony, and you have a chapter looking at that period. This is when we see really great rise in popularity of sports, mass spectator sports, in North America and in Europe. You see the building of massive stadiums, the prominence of sports in popular media. So what was it that fueled this growth of mass spectator sports in the 1920s and into the early 30s?
World War One obviously fundamentally changed the world, particularly Europe, where most of it was fought, but the world as a whole. So there's so in Europe you get the destruction of the old empires, particularly the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and the rise of nationalisms, and those countries that were in the prison house of the Habsburg Empire are now seeking to assert their own national identities and their independence. And sport is an easy way to do that. And again, the one of the ways in which countries after the 1920s looked to assert their independence and their national identity was through the adoption of sport and by its by playing their other rivals. And so it's no accident that really the hotbed of soccer in the 1920s and 1930s was Austria, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, to a lesser extent Germany, Italy, all these countries that had undergone profound changes in World War One. The other important reason, which is intimately linked to that, is the huge importance of the media. I think it's almost, well, I think in the book, and I'm probably regret this, I think in the book I say it's an iron law of sport that its development is intrinsically bound up with the development of media. So in the 1700s, sport arises at precisely the same time that the newspaper newspapers developed. Daily newspapers are first introduced in Britain in the early 1700s. Sport feeds into that and becomes both the subject and the object of newspapers. And in the 1920s, in the beginning of the 20th century, you get the rise of mass circulation dailies across Europe, and particularly in France, you get the rise of mass circulation sports dailies, and they promote sport themselves. And that continues, that's given a huge impetus by World War One, and of course the great technological development that becomes a phenomenon in all countries in the 1920s is radio, which really adds a whole new dimension to sport. One of the things that makes sport a unique form of entertainment for the spectator is the way in which you can get involved. You know, anybody who's been to a baseball game, football match, cricket match, you become involved in it. You're part of the action. But that was unavailable to the majority of people who couldn't go to matches. But radio brought it into people's homes. The impact that radio had across Europe, across North America, I mean, for example, again, and it's something that lots of historians have referred to, is the impact that Joe Louis winning the World Heavyweight Championship had on black America in the 1930s, because you could listen to Joe Louis winning on the radio. You could become part of it, despite the fact you were thousands of miles away. So that had a big impact on the growth of sport in Europe, and there's some very interesting work going on in being done on Germany in the 1920s that shows just how important sport became in the Weimar Republic, partly as a mark of modernity. This is, you know, sport, and particularly football, was part of how this transformation that was taking place in the world was. This was the modern world exemplified. But also later, as political and social upheaval became more important from the late 1920s, early 1930s, and the rise of Hitler, the growth of fascism and nationalist movements in Europe, sport once again becomes a tool of statecraft of political importance. So the clearest example of that is obviously the use that the Nazis put the Olympics to in 1936. But it also becomes a political battleground. So you have the rise of the what were known as the Workers' Olympics. The social democratic and communist movements had their own sports organisations, which in some countries rival that of what we'd see as traditional modern sports. So in many ways, the revolutions that took place, not simply on a political basis in Russia and so on, but in social life and cultural life, that led to sport having this huge, huge importance in Europe. And also, I think we can make the same point in the States as well, in North America, that the rise of radio, the ability of teams to travel, I mean, football, you know, Notre Dame towed the West Coast, you know, popularising Notre Dame as a national football team rather than simply a college football team. The 1920s, the technological revolutions, the political changes in the 1920s really both facilitated the development of sport and its popularity, but also meant that sport could be used by the state for various purposes, not all of them particularly wholesome.
So following on that period of growth for sport in the 1920s, I want to jump ahead to the last chapter of your book, which deals with the massive, massive growth of sport throughout the world in the last 20, 25 years. And you make a key point here in this chapter that the growth in sports, looking in the 80s, 90s, into the 2000s, the growth in sports recently could not have come about without wider shifts in society. So when we look at the various signs of sports expansion since the 1980s, what larger changes does that reveal?
Well, in a sense, it's almost a return to some of the things that gave rise to sport in the 18th century. Obviously, there's technological development. The growth of digital satellite broadcasting has helped to facilitate the rise of sport around the world. I argue in the book that the globalization of sport, it's really about media, because there hasn't been a fundamental shift in the power bases of sport. But one is now able to watch, if you have the money to do so, you can watch pretty much whatever sport you want in whichever country of the world you want because of the growth of satellite broadcasting. But I think more fundamentally that what happened from the 1980s, and if you like, the rise of the Thatcher-Reagan era, which brought in, which really saw the end of the old social democratic welfare consensus, sport became the metaphor of sport that it had in the 18th century, that sport is really about competition. It's about a society that consists of winners and losers, and the important thing is to be a winner. That became much more the dominant narrative of the West in the 1980s and 1990s. And sport, as it rose in importance due to technological changes and the importance of television, sport dovetailed with that ideology. It's sport, obviously, again, because it's a binary thing. It's about winning and losing. And to some extent, it played into that worldview, what people call the neoliberal worldview, that it's really competition is what drives society. That's what produces a healthy society. And so sport was able to, whether consciously or not, came to play a central cultural role in that new world order that Thatcher and Reagan created from the 1980s onwards.
Tony, we're almost out of time, and I want to ask you about something that's been in the news recently. Didn't make it into your book. Your book was already complete and already out before these events, and that's the massive protests that have been in Brazil recently, arising from this popular dissatisfaction with government spending for next year's World Cup. So how would these demonstrations enter into your book if you had the chance? Thinking ahead to the second edition of your book, how would you include the demonstrations in Brazil? Would they change any of the observations you made in your last chapter, or would they confirm your findings?
I'd argue that they actually confirm what I was talking about in the last chapter of the book, because one of the things that concerns me, and other people as well within sport, is the way that sport has become, particularly the mega events like the World Cup and the Olympics, to some extent the UEFA Soccer Championships as well, that these mega events have really, they've become, a way of sort of lauding capitalism through sport and investing huge amounts of money into short-lived sport events that have no, which at best the benefit to the mass of the population is highly disputable, and in many, what I would argue is almost negligible. And certainly there's a debate going on at the moment about the legacy of the London Olympics and the money that the £9 billion that was spent on the Olympics and the actual impact that's had on the local population. I think in Brazil, obviously, that's much more, that issue is much, much sharper because of the huge poverty that the majority of the Brazilian population live in. So in a sense, it's the it's that contradiction between the natural desire of most people to see sporting contests or take part in sporting contests, and the way in which sport has become used as a way of demonstrating national prestige, national prowess, and that has led to countries spending billions and billions on short-lived sporting events that appear to have very little, if any, benefit for the population. I think if you go back over pretty much every Olympics over the last 20 years, you look at the FIFA World Cups. Again, South Africa in 2010, it's difficult to find any benefit that the South African population have had from the vast amount of money that was spent on the 2010 World Cup. So I think it's something that was inevitable and was bound to happen, that sooner or later the population of a country is going to say, wait a minute, we've got very, very important social and economic problems, and can we really afford to spend so much money on what is, after all, a short-lived, ephemeral sporting event. So I think that the and in fact, there's also I've noticed that there's the question of the new Red Wings stadium in Detroit, where you've got a similar issue there. And I think these issues will become more and more apparent as the economic climate throughout the world, not just in South America. As the economic climate becomes harder, the more people will question the necessity of spending so much money on sporting events, sporting stadium, and these high prestige events that really bring no benefit to the working population.
So, Tony, I know I shouldn't ask a historian this question, but what do you see in the future for sports? So revenue from sport keeps going up, ticket prices keep going up. Television ratings keep going up. Do you see a limit or even an end to this growth in the popularity of sport?
It's a difficult question. Clearly, if you look at the TV contracts that have been signed for Premier League soccer in the UK, for NFL football in the or college football in the US, they continue to rise and rise, and it's clear that they've not reached their limit. And developments like the Indian Premier League, the attempts to establish sports in China, mean that I see arena football is even trying to establish itself in China now. It shows that there's a certainly the people in charge of sport and the people in charge of the media don't think that the market has reached its saturation point yet. And I suspect that will be true, that will continue to be true for at least the immediate future, despite economic recession, TV companies are still prepared to pay billions for sports rights. And I guess that's one of the reasons for that, is because sport is such a compelling form of entertainment that, you know, people in hard times, one of the things that make you forget about the problems that you've got for 2 or 3 hours on a Saturday or a Sunday, it's sport. So whether you watch it in your own home or you go down to the pub or the bar to watch a match, at least that sport's endlessly compelling nature means that it will always have an appeal. I think what we will see, though, is probably more and more demonstrations like we've seen in Brazil against mega sports events and against the development of huge super stadiums. But in terms of the sports boom ending anytime soon, I don't really see it. I think the current configuration that we have in the world today of sport will continue at least for the immediate future. Perhaps if things get worse on a much worse on an economic basis, then things may change. But I think fundamentally, modern sport is one of the cultural creations of the modern era. And it is so compelling. It is such a unique form of entertainment that its appeal will not wane. And it's, in some form or another, like the cinema, the other great invention of 20th century modernity, it's always going to be with us. It's always going to be part of human culture.
You've been listening to an interview with Tony Collins about his book, Sport in Capitalist Society, A Short History, published in 2013 by Routledge. New Books in Sports is part of the New Books Network, which offers dozens of channels of podcast interviews with the authors of new publications on subjects from psychoanalysis to East Asian studies. If you like what you heard here, please follow New Books in Sports on Twitter at New Books Sports, or friend us on Facebook at facebook.com/newbooksinsports. I'm your host, Bruce Berglund. Thank you for listening and enjoy your week.